All right, Renee, so good to be with you. I know this is going to be a lot of fun because we know each other really well. But for the sake of the audience to be, let's have you just kind of give us a little bit about who you are and what you're currently doing and maybe how you got to that point.
Awesome. Thanks, John. I'm so happy to be here with you. So my name is Renee Roden, and I'm originally from Eden Prairie, Minnesota, a suburb of the Twin Cities. And I work as a journalist, a freelance religion journalist. I write for America, US Catholic, sort of any outlet that will take my writing. And I actually, for the past several years, I've been working on a book project, which is being published by Liturgical Press this June, which I'm really excited about. It's about one of my favorite places in the world, an institute dedicated to Christian unity in Jerusalem. It's a fascinating place. So that's what I would call my work. That's sort of my vocation, and who I am. And I also live at a Catholic worker house. I first met the Catholic worker when I was a student at Notre Dame studying theater and theology. And then I got better acquainted with it in New York City through the help of you, John, and was pretty involved with that community. And then my partner, James, and I moved to Chicago, where I was living at a Catholic worker house, and he was starting kind of a Catholic worker experiment at a parish up the street. And we just moved to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where we kind of received a Catholic worker house that's been here for 30 years and has had various ups and downs and has sadly suffered many deaths. And so there was one young Notre Dame grad, Kevin, who had been running the house solo for a year. And he was getting ready to enter postulancy with the Franciscans and needed to hand the house off to someone. And so we just moved here to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania to take over this Catholic worker house, which is great. We're sort of just getting to know people. We do hospitality officially one day a week. We have our house open for hospitality, but there's always phone ringing, doorbell knocking, and we just sort of answer that. And we have a small garden out back where we're going to try to live Peter Morin's vision of getting back to the land. So that's like me in a nutshell, I would say.
Yeah, well, that's great. And also, I think it's probably important to just maybe in your words and in your perspective, what is the Catholic worker movement? Who is this guy, Peter Marin, who you just mentioned? I think that maybe a lot of people may have heard or know about Dorothy Day. So, for someone who's really in the movement like yourself, how would you describe the movement, both, let's just say, historically and practically?
Yes, that's a great question. I recently wrote an article about this for Notre Dame Magazine, and they limited me to 3,500 words, which was, yeah, so I'll try to be that brief. So the Catholic worker movement was started in the 1930s by journalist Dorothy Day, who was really praying. She said, she was praying for a way to bring her skills of writing and her love for the poor and this newfound faith. She'd been Catholic for about 5 years. And she went into the Basilica in DC, where she was there on a reporting trip. And she just prayed, God, show me a way where I can use my faith to, care for your poor and and to fight for justice for the working person. And then the next day she went home to New York. She met this guy, Peter Morin, who she always describes as coming to her with St. Francis in one hand and Kropotkin, the anarchist philosopher, in the other. And the rest is history. Peter Morin introduced her to the social program of the church. And she, within 6 months, she was sitting there talking to Peter, learning about all these new encyclicals the popes had been writing, Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum, the 40th anniversary of that Quadragesimo anno, I think I said that right. All these rearticulations of this ancient tradition of the church that, yes, Christ comes to free us from sin. There's a spiritual redemption. That's the primary redemption Christ brings us, but we are an incarnate faith. And so there is a social order that comes out of this new reality of the resurrection. If we believe that we are part of the mystical body of Christ, well, then all of our institutions ought to reflect that fact that we have this great dignity as Christ's body. We have this extreme unity with one another as baptized into the mystical body of Christ. You know, exploitation, greed, alienation, these have no room in the body of Christ, right? And that's really Catholic social teaching in a nutshell, is like taking the resurrection and saying, okay, if we believe in resurrection, which we clearly do, we're an Easter people, then okay, well, what ought that say about these new industrial modes of labor, or what might that say about our relationship with the earth? So that's really the, you know, she wrote in her first editorial in 1933 that the purpose of that paper was to make known to the working man the encyclicals of the popes, that the church has a social message, because the communists had really had a corner on that market at the time. We might not see that so much anymore now, but 90 years ago, really, like, the communists were sort of front and center saying, like, we got to advocate for the rights of the worker, that we should own the means of production, that we should have responsibility and authorship of our labor. And so she very cleverly called it the Catholic Worker, because the most popular communist newspaper was the Daily Worker. So it's just a very, I always, as a journalist and as a media person, I think I'm always so in awe of that decision. It's so smart. It's so clever. It instantly tells you who her audience is and how her message is distinct from what they're receiving in the Daily Worker paper. And then, you know, it just took off like wildfire. Their readership exploded over the first 5 years from like 2,500 copies. Within 3 years, they were printing six figures copies, right? So it really caught, she was speaking something that people were really eager to hear. And so young people flocked to her, and they, you know, were all working on this paper together and living communally. It was the Depression, so there were lots of people out of work. And they, you know, Peter Morin was writing these essays calling for houses of hospitality, and people would come to their office and say, okay, you're writing about this, aren't you going to do it? And so they did. And that's kind of what we think of as Catholic workers now, people living in community. They still exist, right? In New York City is one of the oldest, right? There's two communities that have been around since the 70s when Dorothy was still alive. And there they live in community, practice voluntary poverty. That's sort of one of the key elements of the Catholic Worker, is saying, and that's definitely something we could talk about more because it's very challenging, but this idea of voluntary poverty and being in solidarity with the people you are working with and serving and practicing the corporal works of mercy among, that you're also poor with them, kind of modeling Christ's incarnation and kenosis. And then, yeah, practicing the works of mercy. They're practicing because you never get them right and they never stop, but it's a practice that sort of reforms you also in Christ's image. So, you know, serving soup line is a big Catholic Worker thing, housing the homeless. You know, there's lots of clothing closets, clothing the naked. And so there's there have been almost 300 workers over the past 90 years of its existence, different communities. Some last for a year or less than that. Some last for 50 years. So there's been around like 300 communities since they opened that first one in Lower Manhattan. And I'm drawn to the Catholic Worker because I do find it's, you know, an anarchist movement. So there's very little oversight of how you live out the principles. And really, it's, to me, it's been just a really beautiful program of how I want to live my life as a Catholic. So how I feel I can live my faith economically as an artist and as a writer. I've always asked that question, right? Of like, how do I know what my passion is. I have this very strong sense of what my vocation is and the work I'm supposed to do. And no one, unlike some siblings of mine who code and have a very like delight in coding, and that's work that they love, there isn't like an automatic market for my work that actually can sort of provide a comfortable living in modern American terms. And I think the beauty of that is that it left me asking a lot of questions about, well, why is our economy the way it is? Why is work valued or priced the way it is? Why do homes cost so much? Why, you know, you begin to ask all these economic questions informed by faith, because theology is just the discipline I've been formed in. And it really, the Catholic Worker, I feel like, answered all those questions about like, why, you know, why our society is the way it is, and what are other options Catholics and Christians and people with these same convictions have thought up to make a more just economic reality.
Yeah, well, that's really great, and I mean, I don't think that's too long at all because it was very succinct because you brought in so many different essential components of the story and your story to it. You know, and the thing that I've been thinking about, you know, and a lot of this whole podcast, Religion to Reality, is like, how do we really live the faith in the context that we are in, where it's not just abstract, where it's very tangible, that it's very real. And I just want to just jump in right into this, into just the situation we have at hand. I mean, we all know that we live in a very politically charged time in so many different ways. And no matter who it is that you want to support politically, I find that the Catholic worker movement, Dorothy Day, Peter Marin, was like, that will never be the solution to really the real problem. Because the real problem is that policy, which comes at the hand of the government, will never make everyone completely successful. I mean, even with the best intention, there will always be someone who will kind of be on the losing end of a policy. And sometimes we just think of that as collateral damage. Like, we have to kind of think about things in very utilitarian principles. And so therefore you do the greatest good for the greatest amount. But it seems to me that what Dorothy Day was insistent upon, you can see this with her pacifism, was that you go to the places that people are not talking about, that people are not paying attention to. These are the places that have been treated as collateral damage in the context of policies that mm-hmm. are happening from the top. I don't know if that relates to you, or if that kind of assessment relates to you and what you feel maybe drawn to do, but I feel that at our time right now, especially when you have a lot of Catholics and Christians maybe very happy about, let's say, things happening from the federal government level, there will still be collateral damage from anything that happens at that type of level, especially. And that collateral damage is our human beings, right? people are suffering. I don't know if you could speak a little bit about that, like, because I know that for a lot of people, a lot of Catholics, they get into a very big conflict, like, of who they should be voting for and why they should be voting for them and making all these reasons why this person's the lesser of two evils and this and that. But it seems as if the Catholic worker was like, that's just not a discussion we're really concerned about. We're going to go someplace else. And maybe could you offer that a little bit as, like, this is maybe even some people would say a third way to understand the vocation of the Catholic in a politically charged world that doesn't always see the means of making everyone their best version of themselves?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you bring, I mean, obviously, I have been thinking about this question, as have many other Catholic workers in this moment, other Catholics, other Americans. One of the first things that caught my attention about Dorothy was I found her biography in this very charged, one of many in the United States, very charged political election of 2020. And just, you know, I was thinking about all the conversations I was having with friends about politics in New York City, and I was reading this biography of hers, and I knew who she was, but I'd never encountered, really, I never had read her full story before, nor read much of her writing. And I remember reading that she was imprisoned and kind of the impact of that imprisonment when she was jailed for marching for women's suffrage. It was a very profound experience for her, that experience of going on the Women's March in 1917 and agitating for women's suffrage, but then that she had never cast a vote. So that sort of her political position of anarchism was very interesting, right? Because she was advocating for political power for a group of people who didn't have it at the time, but also she was not willing to endorse anyone in the system, in the state, as someone she saw as a person who would bring a solution. Michael Baxter, a Catholic worker, recently wrote an article in the Houston Catholic Worker about how Dorothy's anarchism really led her to the conviction that the state was always serving its own interests. It was always serving the interests of corporations or the elite. And I do feel that in many corners of the US, there are many people who are having that sense, right, that the government is not serving them. And that's a huge problem for a democracy, because there's not supposed to be an us and a them, or a, like, we are supposed to be self-governing and organizing ourselves, as Peter Morin would say, right? And I think, yeah, I think there's something really beautiful about how the Catholic worker, I think, takes politics down to its first principles, which is, right, like you say, the sort of like classic American partisan politics and political conversation is about big policies, trying to figure out how they're going to impact 300 million people. And so it's a very general conversation that has a lot of, it's talking in big scale, and there's all of these assumptions or concerns Catholics have about it. And I think the Catholic worker brings it down to, okay, wait a second. Politics essentially is how I treat my neighbor and how me and my neighbors work together to, like, we're all living on this piece of land. We're all sharing, however big our neighborhood is, however big, whatever. Like, there's a certain, what it means to be a human and to have a neighbor and to live in a community, a polis, is to share a certain amount of land with a certain amount of people. And right, we seem to be having a very difficult time, which makes sense, being a nation of three, a polis of 300 million across an entire continent, right? Like, it's no surprise that we're finding that very challenging, and how to communicate effectively about how to care for all of our neighbors in this piece of land, or even who counts as our neighbor in this piece of land. And so I think that's the sort of beauty of the Catholic worker, is that it has in it the program of personalism. And personalism, developed by Emmanuel Mounier, French philosopher, you know, he says, he kind of contrasts personalism as a third way to fascism and communism. These two very, those were the political philosophies that had a lot of purchase in the 1930s when he was writing. And he says a personalist society is the one who has that supports and has as its aim the ultimate freedom of each human person. And I think that's something Americans can get behind. We love freedom. And so does the Catholic Church, right? We have a vision of the human person as having free will. We have this great sort of creative freedom that God has to choose the good and to make something really beautiful and good. And yeah, I think personalism is really, like, it always, ultimately, it always comes back down to, like, okay, well, who is the human person? What causes a human person to flourish? Like, are our structures supporting a person's, their ability to seek the good and to choose the good, right? So that's really what personalism is. And I think it, because it's so focused on the flourishing, the spiritual and physical flourishing of each human person, and neither at the expense of the other, it really kind of shrinks our political imagination back down to what I think is a manageable level of, okay, how do I care for this other person in my community? How do I care for my neighbor? Like, I think we have to begin with that if we're ever going to have more productive conversations on a larger scale, right? If we don't even know how to gather together as a block or a neighborhood, how can we gather together as a nation of 300 million?
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. I was giving a homily this past weekend, and it was the whole teaching on loving your enemies. And, you know, people afterwards were saying, you know, but I just have a hard time, like, loving someone like Donald Trump or something like that, you know, and you hear those types of people say that, you know, from all different sides of the political spectrum, there's some person that is really despise. And that's very real. But especially with a political leader who most people do not know personally, nor do they have an actual encounter with, and nor do their policies even usually directly immediately affect them right then and there. I'm like, maybe that's a real big distraction from what it is that you could be doing right now and how you could be living your life very joyfully, despite all the craziness that may be going around you, and despite how much you may disagree with what's happening, you know, from the government level, things like that, from any government level. So I think that the whole works of mercy, which is what the Catholic worker just lives and breathes, is so much rooted on whatever is happening in the present moment in front of you, and which is why the communities themselves are all so distinct and different and doing different things because they're responding to immediate needs, immediate concerns. There's no need to kind of put things in categories or just try to say, well, we're following a model that does XYZ for these types of people that come to our door. That it's just so, like you said, rooted in personalism. It's so unique and particular. Is there any way you can kind of speak about that? Because I think that that's really where the rubber hits the road, as you were saying here. Like, how do you do this? And like, how do you specifically do this as a Catholic worker? And why do you do it the way that you do it, especially in the idea of living in community and voluntary poverty? Two things I think that most people would say would almost infringe on freedom.
Right. Yeah, I remember when I was first getting to know the Catholic worker, my boyfriend James saying to me, this was very challenging. I didn't understand at the time, but he said, voluntary poverty promotes community, right? And voluntary poverty is freeing. And I remember being so befuddled at the time and thinking, right, well, how can I be free to do whatever I want if I don't have money in order to do whatever I want? And I think, yeah, I think it shifts voluntary poverty, which I don't practice perfectly, but it's a practice, right? Because I think you can always see someone. Well, you have a model like St. Francis of Assisi or even Peter Morin, who lives such a pure version of detachment from worldly things. And you think, oh, well, I like my clothes, or I like a comfortable blanket on a couch, or, you know, I like my books. You mm-hmm. still find yourself so attached to material things. But ultimately, the point of voluntary poverty is saying, who do I depend on? Right? Like, am I depending on myself and how strong I am and how capable I am and how smart I am to have saved up so much money and be able to do whatever I want without asking anyone permission or to help me? Or do I depend on God? Do I bring my needs to God and say, hey, like, I really want this, or I really need this, or what is the difference between what I want and what I need? I think I need this, but do I? What do I really need in order to be happy, to be joyful, to live the life that I feel, yeah, brings me to life? And yeah, do I really trust God, right? It's that question over and over again, which is at the core of the gospel. Like, do you really trust God? Do you really serve God and not mammon? Do you really like think God is going to save you, right? And that the God who's made sparrows and knows when they die actually cares about you physically, you know, materially, emotionally, spiritually. I think you realize too that, you know, what's a community a lot of us are familiar with? Family, right? And that unit is based off of material need, right? You come into the world needing something. And I think one of the things we do have a little wrong in the US is that community, you can have community without needing one another. Like, I think you do need one another in a very real material way, not in just a emotional, oh, I need friends and I don't want to feel lonely. It's more fulfilling to, it's more meaningful, it's more human in some ways to have a community in which you depend upon each other. And then when you have that community, you look less to maybe those things you might call distractions, right? Like, but I think it begins to, when you have that community of dependency, you begin to look towards each other and at each other instead of away. So when you say that thing of like seeing a political figure as a distraction, I would probably say they are, right? Like that, you know, yes, the state can make rules that really impede people's well-being and flourishing. I think working with, you know, for the past 4 years, working with a lot of folks who are unhoused or really housing insecure, I don't know if it's so much the party that's in power that makes poor Americans' lives difficult as much as it just is the system, the economic mm-hmm. system that's here, and that no party really has changed yet. So I think I've wandered from your question a little bit.
No, that's all good stuff though, Renee. It's really okay. Good. But we can shift to something here that's directly connected to the discipleship study. So So we see that in the discipleship study that people's greatest need for growth was the expressive fruits. So there was lots of people who very much as a Catholic identify with participation in the sacraments, Sunday Mass, and being able to have some type of devotional life, prayer life. Where things kind of fall short is making concerted efforts, ongoing efforts to live acts of mercy, to bestow acts of mercy, to embody acts of mercy, that somehow gets a little bit pushed to the side. That for one to be fully Catholic means, yes, they are showing up for Mass, they are participating in the sacramental life of the Church, they believe the Church's teachings, and they do their best to live the moral teachings and things like that. But when it comes to works of mercy, it's like there's just not this high level of accountability that would somehow be distinctly Catholic, which is interesting, right? Because it almost seems as if other people who aren't going to church are the ones who are taking the lead in doing very merciful acts of compassion in the world. So like how, and Dorothy Day and Tahir Morton are perfect people who were able to show that these both feed each other, that they're not exclusive, they're not separate tracks. They really feed each other. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because the dichotomy between, say, the sacramental life and the works of mercy life, if we're going to call it that, that those two tracks don't need to be two.
Yes, I think that's, well, immediately your question makes me think of just how many people will often come to Catholic worker houses and say, well, I don't feel like this is the one place that's sort of keeping me in the Catholic Church, or this is a place where I feel like I can be Catholic, and maybe they don't find that belonging in church. And I find that a very interesting comment. And I, in some ways, I think, oh, interesting. It occurred to me that they were saying something very true, that to be Catholic, we are supposed to be living out our faith, not just going to liturgy and worshiping together in church, not just the sort of, not just the liturgical aspect, but actually like we needed to also like, we need to live, we want to be Catholic. I think people are just dying to find ways to be Catholic. And to have to really truly be marked by their faith. Mm. And the liturgical movement was such a huge influence on Dorothy and Peter that, you know, the late 19th century, early 20th century movement to really recenter the sacrifice of the Mass as the center of our devotional life as Catholics. We take that for granted now after Vatican II, right? That, you know, some of us aren't praying rosaries during Mass or during the Stations of the Cross, that we're all locked in, we're doing the Mass together. This is something we, the people of God, are part of and participating in fully. But that was really a reform of the liturgical movement, like taking us back to that root of our faith, right? Of those Sunday Eucharists that the first Christians would practice. So restoring that centrality of the Eucharist in Catholic life. And part of that, you know, Virgil Michael, one of the liturgical movement's leaders, was great friends, huge fans of Dorothy and Peter, of the work they were doing. He was so excited because one of the convictions of the liturgical movement was that the Eucharist contained a call for us to go be Eucharist in the world, right? To become what we received, as you say at the end of Mass, like go out to love and serve the Lord, right? Like Mass is actually a commissioning and a call. It's not just like, oh, great, come here again next week. It's like, no, there are 7 days a week. Like, go live this every other 6 days. And I think that's the role, you know, of the works of mercy and the social teaching of the Church. Is it shows us a program of like, this is how to live the Eucharist in our lives. And so I think, you know, it's interesting because I do feel like also coming at this from the other way, we can't have this division of just like, oh, well, I'm a soup kitchen person, this is my jam, and I'm a adoration person. Pope Francis says in The Joy of the Gospel that churches should not be serving the material needs or meeting the material needs of the poor and neglecting their spiritual needs. So really what he's calling us to do is to say, no, like our communities have to be integrated. We have to be we can't just say, oh, well, like the poor go to the soup kitchen. It's like, no, you should be at the soup kitchen, sitting down, talking to someone, learning their name, learning their story. Maybe there's something you can do for them materially, but you should, you know, invite them to Bible study, see if they want to come to mass, you know, like, if they're Catholic, you know, you don't have to go like, proselytize in ways people don't want to hear, but, you know, but basically extend that community that you're a part of, that faith community is not just for the people who are helping, it's also for the helped. And I think that's the goal of the Catholic worker, really, is to say there is no division between people who do the helping and the helped. I'm not just a helper. Like, the point of the works of mercy is we're all supposed to be doing it for each other, right? Mm-hmm. We all come into this world needing to be fed and needing mm-hmm. to be clothed. And we don't lose that need or that, you know, that opportunity to give someone else the chance to practice the work of mercy on our behalf, you know?
Yes. Excellent. I mean, I often like to think that in some ways, like you mentioned Eucharistic adoration or even the Mass itself, like these moments with the Eucharist, which I think it can mean so many different things for so many different people, what the Eucharist is. I think it's impossible to just encapsulate what the Eucharist is. But one way I like to personally look at it is that there's something about working the muscle of being able to gaze and receive something which you know is more than what it is it appears to be. So this piece of bread, this chalice of wine, to know that there's something more to it than meets the eye, which we call the body and blood of Christ. And to be able to constantly work that muscle in the sacramental context. So when you show up in the world, you're still working that muscle when you encounter a person on the street. They're more than what they appear to be. They're more than what they're wearing. They're more than when the last time they had their bath. I mean, like, there's something more hidden, which is the reality of Christ's presence in the world. I often think like that's perhaps the best way to bring a synergy to the sacramental and the active works of mercy life. To be able to recognize that I'm not just doing something that's just somehow for the sake of the ritual, that there's an actual practice happening here, whether I'm even fully aware of it or not, that I'm participating in something that is a training ground for how I show up in the world. And I don't know if that speaks to you, or if you think that's something that could possibly be proposed to more people to give it a chance. I do feel like that we are in a world right now that is craving silence and is craving just a way to kind of, not maybe like check out necessarily from the world, but as a way to kind of detach. There's so many things I want to say right now, so I'll leave it at that for now. But does any of that speak to you?
I love that, John. I think that's such a great insight. I think taking up what you said about the Eucharist and how it says something about, I remember recently someone was saying, you know, oh, we wish we could extend the hours of our Eucharistic adoration so that it was like more hours, blah, blah, blah. And my first thought, because I'm such a snarky little person, is I was just like, oh, well, good thing we have the poor 24/7, you know, on which to visit Christ then. But I think it's so true that the Eucharist is telling us something about who God wants to be for us and who God is in creation. And right, that is a God who, you know, we can't escape from, who is always trying to encounter us. And I just think it's so beautiful. I was recently reflecting on, I remember one of the first articulations of holiness I recall was John Paul II. And they said, oh, John Paul II would look at you like you were the only person in the room. And as a kid, I was like, whatever, that doesn't seem that special. Anyone can do that. And then as an adult, you realize, oh, actually a lot of people don't do that. They're often looking over your shoulder to see where the bishop is or like, who's the more important person I could talk to? Where's the publisher or editor I want to speak to? You know, like, to actually see each person and give them that dignity of you are the only person there. What it kind of reveals, I think, is a soul who's so open to seeing God and is so, who understands that in every person he or she encounters, they have the opportunity to see God and to learn more about who God is and to have an encounter with the God they love more than anything else in the world. Mm-hmm. And I just love what you said about how it's like, we have this deep faith that what looks like bread to the world that people do mock, they think it's funny, you know, that we actually look at that and say, no, that is Christ. And it's like, how powerful would our witness be to the world if Catholics lived that way, where it's like, oh, they look at that person and they see God, they see Christ. Like, that's the witness of the first Christians, right? See how they love one another. Like, that is truly, like, I think that that radical vision is at the heart of Eucharist. And like you say, at the heart of a practice of our works of mercy.
Yeah. So I think it was in your last blog, maybe, that you referenced this book.
Yes. How to Do Nothing, Jenny O'Dell.
Yeah. So I think you said chapter two. So I reread chapter two last night. And I think you kind of mentioned it in your blog, I think almost like in a way to kind of almost be a way to call out the Catholic workers' attempt at community, that it's so idealistic that it doesn't really hold, and therefore it becomes quickly compromised and then falls apart, or it goes into some type of dictatorial type of reign that it almost mimics the very society that it was trying to escape. Did I get it right?
Those are your words, not mine.
Did I get it right?
I think, yeah, you're picking up on something I'm putting down. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I should reread what you wrote, but I mean, I guess what I'm just trying to say here is, like, how practical is this whole Catholic worker stuff? Let's put it from that angle. I mean, we talked about it one person at a time, but I'm talking more about the community itself, creating a society out of the shell of something old to create something new. You know, like, tell me a little bit more about your experience with that, because people could be very inspired to be like, all right, I'm going to, like, and, you know, I've had my own experience. I'm going to go run off to this monastery. I'm going to run off to this community. I'm going to do these things here, because, like, this is where people are getting it right. And then you quickly realize, like, oh, it's not as good as I thought it was, or I'm not committed to it, I guess, in the way that I thought I could have been. So, like, could you just talk a little bit about your experience with community in within the context of the Catholic worker and what that really ultimately means within the church?
I think, yes. So, one, I remember talking to a Benedictine monk about struggles I was having in a community, and he said, oh, well, yeah, community life is hard. And I was like, yes, it is. However, you have a 1300-year-old rule that guides you, and you have 2 years of, you know, novitiate to understand that rule, plus, you know, an abbot. Like, you have a lot of structures you've agreed upon about what it means to be a monk in that community that can at least, they're guardrails, you know, they're something to hold on to as you navigate that difficult sort of communal life together. I think the problem in a lot of Catholic worker communities is very simple, which is just that there's not enough clarification of thought of what it means to even be a Catholic worker, what the goals are. And those are very basic things you have to answer in order to function together as a community. So I actually think this is not original to me. There are other people in the movement who had this insight, but I've come to agree with them, is that the Catholic worker movement seems to be thriving in many ways amongst families, right? And so I've met many families who have decided, you know, they've read Dorothy and Peter's work and they say, oh, we can practice this in our household. I know one family that has 4 children, and, you know, whenever they decide to take in a guest, they, like, move all the kids, they kind of rearrange their house to create a guest suite for the guests that they will take in off the street, or that a shelter will call them for overflow. So they're very committed to that radical vision. And I do think there's a natural stability to family life. You know, like, I think intimacy is a really foundational key for a community. It gets lost, but you need intimacy. You need friendship. You need to feel like you're seen. And so, you know, within a marriage, hopefully you have that between a husband and a wife, naturally, that commitment of, like, okay, the goal of all this kind of like the Eucharist, right? The goal of all of whatever we're doing is ultimately just for us to love each other better so that we can love God better, you know, and that need to know and love and see the other person is so central to what a marriage and a family is that it's a solid basis for a community, which you're not always guaranteed to have at a lot of the countercultural communes that Jenny O'Dell brings up. I thought her insight is, I just find it so wise. You know, she talks about how so many communes and in disaster and in like, you know, the genius who wants to escape the capitalist system said it, you know, he becomes his own dictator. And I think you see that, you do see that in a lot of countercultural communes, unfortunately. But I also think the reason that is because that's the temptation of all our own hearts, you know, and it's so hard to convert your own heart over and over and over again. And if you're not in a healthy community that supports you in that journey and is full of people committed to that together, it's going to go south so quickly, right? Mm-hmm. Whether that's a marriage, a monastery, a Catholic worker community, like it takes a lot of personal accountability. So I do think that the Catholic worker is a very practical vision, but I think one of the things one of the sort of wisdoms that I feel like I've learned is that if you want to start a Catholic worker, you should first, I think first comes your friends, you know, first comes the people that you know. I know some friends in North Carolina who started their kind of Catholic worker community. You know, they were just all friends and they sat and read a Catholic worker book together and then they read another one, you know, so it kind of began with friends who all were longing for the same thing. And I think that's a very necessary component. I think also I would say community, I've come to see community much more about me and my neighbors versus like who I share a household with on some level. Mm. Or I think that's the more important community to focus on for a Catholic worker. Like you might think, oh, I'm not a Catholic worker. I don't live with 10 other people. That doesn't mean anything, you know, like you can live in an apartment alone, but if you are practicing hospitality as much as you can, you know, trying to organize with your neighbors, having these clarification with thoughts of friends, trying to create that community, even if you don't all share the same roof, I think that's very much in the organizing spirit of the Catholic worker.
Yeah. And maybe as we're kind of winding down, let's talk a little bit about some of the more difficult or controversial aspects of the Catholic worker movement. There's a lot of younger people, let's say, who find Dorothy Day in some way. They read her Long Loneliness autobiography, or they're introduced to her in some capacity and they get really excited. And then they try to find a Catholic worker house that they can say, oh, well, let's see how this is all lived. And there he is. There's the guy who lives it right there, James. So they, you know, they're all excited and they go to try to find a community and they're quickly disheartening because in the community they feel like, well, the brand of Catholicism that I grew up on, which was very, let's say, mass centric, sacramentally driven, that doesn't seem to be part of the community. So like, how do Catholic workers negotiate through all these different types of Catholic workers who have all different types of things of, say, Dorothy and Peter's vision that they latch onto, and some of the more explicitly Catholic things that people would say are like connected to doctrine, dogma, sacraments, rituals? Those things are not necessarily something that they're in for. So like, what could you tell someone who's, you know, disillusioned by that? Let's just say that.
I really haven't personally had that experience, but yes, I have talked to people who've had that experience. I think one thing that I've noticed is that young people go on to create their own houses, right? They find a like-minded person, whether that's a friend, a romantic partner, and they create their own houses. And I've seen some of the most creative Catholic worker houses that I admire, that I feel like have a fresh new vision, are completely committed Catholics. They have a beautiful liturgical life, and they, yeah, have a lot of energy, right? They're a bunch of young people, kind of like those first Catholic workers in New York. They have a lot of energy and they're on fire. And so I think I would, you know, kind of advise someone to look for that kind of community if that's what they're looking for. They're easy to find online at the Catholic Worker website. I also think, you know, talking to people who've been in more difficult community situations, you know, the beauty of the Catholic Worker is that it's just a space of radical welcome. There's always asterisks because we're imperfect humans, so it may not always feel that way to people, especially if you live here. But yeah, they are spaces of radical welcome. They're so rare, and they draw a lot of people who've never felt belonging anywhere else, and did, whether by the church, by society, like you name it, right? So they draw a bunch of like very wounded people to them a lot of time. I think they're often so engaged in healing and responding to the immediate needs of people outside their community. There's often not a lot of energy or time to like heal one another in the community. So I think that that can sometimes lead to those dysfunctions. And I think, yeah, I think there's always, there's what's always really interesting is I think even if folks in the house have had a bad experience with church or are no longer interested in participating in that life, I always find that people at churches are often very interested in getting to know the worker. So that can also be like a helpful infusion of life and energy and hope of inviting, you know, folks from your parish to come over. And I think that can sometimes, yeah, create, it won't often heal wounds or heal divisions, but it can, you know, create this new sense of positive engagement with the church. Yeah, I remember one of our parishioners who helped run the food pantry in Chicago. You know, she had a lot of questions about the Catholic Worker because she was very confused because she remembered the Catholic Worker. I can't remember what they were doing. There was some like pro-life or pro-choice rally, and they were, she remembers them like not reflecting the church's message on it. So she was very confused what the Catholic Worker was. And I think that's where, you know, we would have just explained who Dorothy was and kind of the original vision of the Catholic Worker, and that it is anarchist, and people apply this message in lots of different ways. That some ways people would describe as unorthodox, some as orthodox. And so really it's important to just kind of look around and find the community that you feel like represents your Catholic faith. But also I think there's an invitation to dialogue. You know, Catholic workers are Americans just like anyone else, so they're not always the best at dialogue, but like, I think that's also, I feel like what we're called to do is to try to like the Catholic worker tradition of clarification of thought of like, okay, well, why do you think this way? Why do you feel this way? That's really hard to do in community when you're living on top of each other as well, to have that space to encounter the other person as a person and say, well, why do you want to do it this way? Or why do you think this way about the church?
Religion to Reality is an initiative of DeSales Media created by me, Dave Pliske, and is produced and edited by Connor Donnelly. If you found value in our conversation, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. If you love the show, ratings and reviews go a long way toward letting others know about the show. Go to religiontoreality.org for more details and resources.